She came to the United States with a tiny record collection to keep her from getting too lonely for home. Faithful listeners to The Thistle and Shamrock may want to thank Fiona Ritchie for that, because it started a stream of music flowing to the United States from the Celtic world that has been uninterrupted and growing since 1981. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC. It's a pleasure to welcome Fiona Ritchie to Conversations.
Thanks.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
You can't have had any idea that that little box of records was going to start what it started. Do you sometimes feel that it picked up your life and put your life on its path?
Yeah, things definitely changed and in a way that I couldn't possibly have predicted and wasn't aware of at the time, nor for a good while thereafter. That was a tiny record collection too. I had absolutely no business saying I would do a record program on the back of the dozen records I had with me. Yeah. When I was asked, would I do a weekly program? Sure, I'll do a weekly show. And then I went back to Scotland for Christmas and came back with bushels of records, and it sort of began from there.
Did you know then that something was happening?
No, not at all. I mean, I was interested in radio, and I got attracted to the sound of public radio when I came over to the United States, returning after having spent 6 months here as an exchange student. I came back and my ear tuned into public radio, which was a new sound in the North Carolina community where I was living. And I thought, that sounds really great. And so I went down there to become involved with the radio station because I thought it was an important contribution to that community. And the invitation to do a program was something that kind of grew out of my being there. Why don't you do a music program on music from wherever it is you're from, sort of thing? So I did that, and there was no way of knowing at the time that it would capture the imaginations of the local community and from there then be presented to a national audience. And even when that happened, I remember thinking that, oh, this will maybe go down well in Chicago and places where there are a lot of, you know, Irish people or something. There was no way for me to understand that the music that I grew up with, or the music from my homeland, has a universal appeal. You can't know that. You think it's just your own thing and that other people might not find it very accessible. And then to find that the music had some kind of broader appeal was something that I learned along the way. People who were listening to the programme were more aware of that than I was for a long time.
Did you learn this from letters, phone calls?
Yeah, letters and just the appeal of the programme and the fact that it was being broadcast in you know, such a wide variety of communities, and we were hearing from people from all kinds of family backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, age groups and that kind of thing. And so that was a learning experience for me to understand that, you know, music really does have a broad appeal if presented in a way that people can get into it, and that you shouldn't say, this is the kind of music you'll like, and,
yes,
and second guess people like that.
Yeah.
So I don't do that.
Now, let's say that someone out there has never heard Thistle and Shamrock. A capsule. What is it that you do every week?
We play some good music. The music to me is driven by the emotion that's in the music and the love of the music of the folks who are playing it and singing it. So it's music kind of these people with a personal energy in the music. The music happens to come from that part of the world that we might call the Celtic world, the Celtic lands. But that, I think, is not what's the most important thing about the music. Many people tune in and listen, and they don't have a clue really where Scotland is. Maybe they don't have a family connection or anything that brings them to music, but what they've enjoyed is the sound of it. Mm-hmm. And so whilst I'm delighted and I want people to tune in who have that family background, their granny was from Ireland or their, you know, their ancestor was from Scotland, and it connects them to a place that they feel connected to and that's important to them, you know. I want that to happen, but at the same time, I want people to just hear it and think it sounds interesting and different and fresh and that it touches them in a way that doesn't have to be to do with any historical background. So I'm always trying to balance that out, to appeal to people who know a lot about the music already and who will have a deep reason to love it, and also to people who've never heard it before and just think, that sounds interesting and different and fresh, and I'll just listen again next week.
You tuned into Conversations. Our guest today is Fiona Ritchie, and we're talking about the program she produces, first from North Carolina and now from Edinburgh, called Thistle and Shamrock. Is that what you want to leave people with at the end of the hour, is a balance of kind of the tune and the teaching, the emotion and...
Yeah, I think when I first started doing the program, when I first went to North Carolina, first spent time in the US, in fact, before public radio days, when I was over just as a student, I realised that much as, you know, Scots are quite proud of their own country and we like to think we've made a contribution to the world, you know, most people don't really know much about Scotland and they have a lot of very funny stereotypes and a very narrow view, which is true. We're all like that with our view of other countries of the world, or can be. Mm-hmm. And so, but at that young age, I was a bit disappointed that, you know, people had a strange stereotypes of Scotland, and they would say things like, you know, you speak really good English, Fiona, and do you all have, you know, telephones in Scotland? And I would say, a Scotsman invented the telephone, didn't you know? So, I mean, you know, you kind of sort of think, gosh, people don't really know much about... So I think when I first started doing the programme, there was a little bit of me that wanted to show people that there was a lot more to my homeland and the related cultures of Ireland and the Celtic world. So there was, I wouldn't say it was a soapbox, but I think initially I was quite keen to sort of say, look, you know, listen, there's more to it than you thought, and a little bit of desire to expand people's minds and maybe turn a few stereotypes on their head in the gentlest possible way. But since those early years, I think, you know, I left that behind a little bit, and it's just a desire to delve into the music, the history behind it, the lore. What it can tell us about people's lifestyles, what's important to people in that part of the world, so people can learn about that. But I think there are some fairly general messages and ideas and notions that come across in the music that I try and let them just be there too, and maybe not to say too much about it sometimes.
I hear a lot of let in your language, that you're letting things come through now rather than pushing things through.
It's a music program. The music and the song that I'm featuring is the program, and I have an opportunity to put that out there. But I'm not sitting with a fiddle under my chin and singing all these songs. I'm giving the music over, so I sort of get to share it, if you like. That's how I feel about it.
I read somewhere in a publicity file that you felt at some point, now I honestly don't know how recent this is, bolder in another way. And the example was, I used to think I couldn't bring a classical piece written for the bagpipes onto the show because the ears wouldn't be educated enough to get it. So there's a freeing up in that way too. You're bringing less mainstream, more specific?
I think that I learned pretty early on to start to just trust the audience to kind of go with me. Initially, when you start to do a programme, you then become concerned pretty quickly, especially if it reaches some measure of success and suddenly you're on, you know, you have a national radio programme. You start to imagine then that people have a set expectation of what it is you're going to do and are going to want you to remain within that. And you think, you know, have to fulfil people's expectations of the show. But there was such a wide spectrum of music that I started to pretty quickly want to step out of whatever that limit might have been. And people are happy to come along and listen in, you know. So, yes, initially I would have been much more cautious about, could I play this chamber orchestra with Ilan pipes dancing through the musical mix, or this kind of crossover piece of music that's actually sort of almost like country music, but it's from Ireland. And now I don't really worry about that. I just do that. And I think people have listened for a long period of time know pretty much what I'm doing with the show, and they've been happy to come with me on some fairly grand departures from that. And that's fine. I don't worry too much about what fits. You know, I think music is far too highly categorised and you know, put in pigeonholes anyway, and I don't want to contribute to that, so I try not to at all.
Good. This is Fiona Ritchie. Give us a geography lesson. For those people who say, Scotland, I don't know, it's somewhere over there, right? Tell me what makes up a list of Celtic countries and regions.
Well, Ireland would be most people's first country that would come to mind. If you're talking about something Celtic or Gaelic or whatever, they'd think Ireland, that's true, the country of Ireland. Scotland, in the, you know, we have the United Kingdom. People over here have a hard time with what's Britain, what's Great Britain, what's the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Basically, I suppose the United Kingdom is those countries that came together, Scotland, England, Wales, and Northern Ireland is the United Kingdom. Scotland and Wales are also related as part of this Celtic fringe. There's a little tip of England, the very southwest, the little boot of England, the toe, called Cornwall. You can kind of, if you imagine the British Isles, we should have a map and I should be pointing with a stick and everything.
Just going to keep your pointing appropriate, it would work.
If you sort of see where people were pushed further out over time to a fringe of Europe, Scotland and the Hebrides and the islands around, Ireland, Wales, this little bit Cornwall, and then likewise there's a little bit that sticks out of France, Brittany, and a related little part of Spain, which was part of a migration back down from Celtic people as they were being pushed out to these fringes. Some of them got in boats and said, let's go back to some of these other coastal areas. So it really is the very western fringe of Europe.
That's what I was wondering about. This is a migratory path that has left collections of people here and there.
Yes, and as Europe during the many centuries gone by, there was some great movements of people and mingling of people. And these areas are, I suppose, the most remote parts of Europe, the very western fringe. I mean, there are other very remote parts by virtue of their elevation and such like, and very, you know, remote valleys of the Alps and all that. And they have their interesting little ethnic structures and all in there too. But this basically is the very western fringe of Europe, people getting pushed further and further out. And then by virtue of their inaccessibility, the culture, language, lifestyles, people, it all remains just a little bit more intact, I suppose. Inaccessible to that continuing mix and movement. So you have then languages that are really ancient, unrelated to any other languages of the world. They are in a group of their own, the Celtic languages. And you have music, which harks back to a really ancient time, as well as dances and such like, you know, even clothing styles. Not that we walk around anymore with ancient types of garb on, but the sorts of clothes, the plaids and such like. I mean, some of these ideas and the look of these people does date back a very long time. But then there were other incursions. I mean, there were Vikings coming in from the Norse lands and becoming part of that culture and other movements that contributed. It wasn't a total time capsule, but basically that's what we're talking about. That's the geography.
And in terms of traditions, these are all locked into a small group of influences that have radiated out to become what we think of as Celtic tradition in music or dress or culture?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the most powerful way that the Celtic heritage has, the most obvious, most powerful way it has sustained through time is through the music. The languages, of course. But language isn't something that you necessarily so much share with the world. You either speak the language or you don't. Now, it has bled into the English language. I mean, there are words like galore, which is a Scots Gaelic word, you know, that we all use. I guess you use the word galore. Right. And other words that feed into the main dominant language. But the music seems to me to be a more powerful way that it has held over. And I don't know, it's a very... It operates on a much more emotional level. Language can be emotional too, but it's obviously an intellectual exercise too, whereas music just sort of sings out from people and somehow, maybe unnoticed, it continues on in a more powerful way. I suppose over time, when you're trying to maybe control people or say, look, here's the dominant country here, you can say, you know, you can't speak your language or you can't wear these clothes, but music is a much more difficult thing to control, and maybe that's why it's sustained more through the years and become an important way for people to express themselves when other ways of expressing themselves, other routes of expression have been cut off. Mm-hmm. It becomes a way for people who feel they need to express themselves to do so. And Scots are not known for being very sort of overtly passionate, emotional people. But if you listen to their music, there's a lot of emotion, passion in the music.
There seems to be such a range of types of music within the Celtic tradition. Can you again, verbally introduce us to some of those?
Yeah, I think most people, when they think of Celtic music, well, they're either going to think of, you know, Irish balladeers, people singing songs like Danny Boy.
Right.
Or they're maybe going to think of Scots pipe bands, which are a very powerful image. And those are both parts of that tradition. But there's a lot more. The most ancient instrument, I suppose, from Ireland and Scotland, and both countries like to argue about, you know, where it started out. It doesn't matter. It probably started out in Egypt or somewhere anyway. Is the harp, you know, a very ancient instrument. It goes back to ancient times, and there are early documentations of harpers and bards. You know, the Romans wrote a lot about the Celts because they were one of the people who helped to push them to where they are now as the Roman mm-hmm. Empire grew. So that would be the first big movement of Celts. So there are lots of early documentations of Celtic people playing harps and weaving tales and poetry through harp music. Harp is an ancient instrument. The pipes, also very ancient, but many different types of pipes, not just the proud Scottish war pipes, the Highland pipes, but Irish Uilleann pipes, and loads of little beautiful little bellows-blown instruments, which were common all over Europe in any country that had a kind of pastoral tradition and a herding tradition, because they were outdoor instruments. And then also the fiddle. I mean, those would be the three main instruments, although flutes and other instruments. Banjos, I mean, the banjos are originally an African instrument, but it's come into Celtic music, been there for a long time, accordions and such like. But really, if you look at the harp and pipes and fiddle, you've got the backbone of the instrumental tradition. And then there's the vocal tradition, the ballads, many different types of singing styles, some of which actually overlap with instrumental styles. In Scotland, you have mouth music, which is a way of making dance music through singing sometimes nonsense syllables that will follow the rhythms of a reel or a jig and actually echo a lot of pipe ornamentation. That grew at a time when instruments were either not available or were actually proscribed, you know, and you couldn't play the pipes for a period in there. So the vocal tradition grew out of some of those necessities, as well as being a wonderful way of, I mean, I always think the ballads of Scotland and Ireland were, you know, the National Enquirers of their time, you know. three girls found dead by well, you know, brother implicated, these types of things. Incredible headlines and these wild stories in the ballads. But they were also ways of sharing news, recording events of the day, battles, and capturing the lifestyle of regular folks. You know, they weren't all written about kings and noblemen and the famous people of the day, but they often captured very intimate, personal little stories of people who are now anonymous to us in time. So they're ways of really hearing voices from the past through the ballads. So, I mean, those are some of the musical strands, instrumental and vocal, that exist in that music.
This is Fiona Ritchie on Celtic Musical Traditions. You're watching and listening to Conversations. A little background on Fiona. She graduated with honours from the University of Stirling in Scotland. In 1981, she had spent 6 months... Six months in Charlotte, North Carolina on an internship, I think, in psychology. Then went back home to Scotland and graduated, returned to North Carolina again for a short stint, thinking to take a short job, fell in love with public radio, created a radio program for Charlotte, North Carolina's brand new public radio station. That program went national, and we have history in the making with Fiona Ritchie. First APR picked up Thistle and Shamrock, and
yes.
Then it went to National Public Radio in 1986 and has been with National Public Radio ever since that time. In 1990, Fiona took her program back to Edinburgh, where she produces it every week. This is Conversations on KUAC. I want you to go back and stop and look at the pipes for a minute or two again. One does just think of a bagpipe, I think, if you thinking of the narrowest Celtic tradition. You said any bellows-driven pipe. Is that the generic description that covers a range of pipes?
There are other pipes other than the ones blown by the piper involving, you know, the mouthpiece and the chanter and the bag and the drones and that whole
right.
incredible array. There are many little types of pipes in Scotland, as you'll maybe be familiar with the Irish ones, which also fit into this category, which don't require blowing from the mouth, but there's a bellow under one arm and a bag under the other. And with this wonderful little dance, they provide air to make the music. Now, in Scotland, we call them the cold windpipes, as opposed to the hot air that is blown in the larger pipes, cold windpipes. So, yes, there are those. They also exist in the very north of England, the Northumbrian pipes. And they're in some ways, whilst they don't have the sort of power and incredible majesty of the Highland pipes, they are more versatile too, because they are softer, sweeter, and can be played therefore more easily with other instruments. So they're more of a chamber instrument and are popular again after almost dying out. So many of these little types of pipes have been making a tremendous comeback in Scotland and in England and in Ireland. And it's been wonderful to see, because it's revived a whole lot of old tunes that would never have been heard that were, you know, set for these pipes.
Why were they banned?
Well, there was a period in Scotland after our last great stand against the English government forces. Maybe wrong to say England versus Scotland, because there was a lot of sympathy on both sides also for each other's side. It was a very complicated political situation, but it was to do with replacing the Stuart monarchy on the British throne. Their rightful lineage was to the Stuarts, and they'd been replaced by the Hanovers. And there was a religious element too. The Stuarts were Catholic monarchy, the Hanoverians Protestant. So that was part of the picture. But the last stand against the monarchy that had been put in place was with the Jacobite Rising of 1745 under the grandson of the last Stuart king, Bonnie Prince Charlie, who came back from exile in France to lead an uprising. And they were really successful, wildly successful, and they got very close to London. But some of their support and supplies started to run out, so they ended up making a retreat back up towards Scotland. They won a few battles along the way and then prepared for the last stand, the great big battle that took place in 1746 in the very north of Scotland. And it was a terrible affair, you know, where they were basically quite seriously and tragically defeated, with a lot of loss of life. And that became the last land battle fought on British soil in 1746. So after that happened, they said, OK, we have to knock these clans on the head. We have to sort of stop this kind of thing from happening again. And there were a whole lot of laws thrown pretty heavily on the lifestyle of the clans, which were kind of broken up. The clan chiefs basically had a choice whether to show allegiance to the crown and get and retain some of their power and lands, or whether to continue rebelling. And many of them basically threw in their lot with the government by that time. So the people were, a whole lot of things happened really, but basically banned from wearing the kilt and the tartans, banned from playing the pipes, this great symbol of Scottish nationhood and spirit, I suppose. It was the war pipes. They were intended to be intimidating to the adversary. And, I mean, there were a whole lot of other little laws. I think for a period they weren't even allowed to use knives and forks, because these would have been, you know, weaponry. And then there were all the clearances eventually, which led to so many Highland Scots going to, you know, North Carolina and Nova Scotia. And, you know, there were a whole lot of people left and were moved out as it became obvious that sheep would be a more profitable livestock to have on the land than people crofting in small farms. So that was really the beginning, 1746, on that battle of some vast sweeping changes in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. But it's also maybe why so much of the music made it over to North America and blended in with other types of music and created that great musical bridge that we enjoy looking at.
Especially today.
Yeah.
Is this the period of the Mad Ladies from Hell? When I think of Scottish warriors, that's the phrase I think of.
I think that was the Germans during the Second World War, and perhaps the first, who dubbed them the Mad Ladies from Hell. Because after the pipes were banned, the reason they were able, that they sustained to be as pop, continue to be as popular as they are today, was because they realised pretty quickly, when they started to recruit Scotsmen from all over the country, but especially from the Highlands, for regiments, for all kinds of wars that were going on, that if they could create Scottish regiments where the wearing of the kilt was the uniform and the playing of the pipes was actively encouraged, it was a really good way to get Scotsmen to come into the regiment. So piping took on a regimental identity, which has, you know, remained to this day. And there are regimental pipe bands. The pipes are still played in regimental settings and in battle settings. And there are some really fairly amazing stories from even the Second World War, where the piper would stand on the most obvious position on some bridge parapet and play throughout some terrible trench warfare battle in France, and the Germans, by just kind of an unspoken agreement, wouldn't take him down. Huh. They just had a sort of respect for it, I guess. So there are many stories of Scots pipers playing to the end, and it's always been considered a way of stirring up Scots adrenaline, which I think many of you folks can realise. I mean, the pipes has that, that feeling, yeah. And it is supposed to also make those for whom it is not intended to get them excited actually recoil in horror. And there's always a certain amount of people who run when they hear the pipes and don't like the sound.
It seems knowing that the Scots are coming over the hill.
The
right?
Mad ladies from hell.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Fiona Ritchie is with us on Conversations. In 1992, the program Thistle and Shamrock and its producer and host Fiona Ritchie were given the Flora MacDonald Award from the Scottish Heritage Centre of St. Andrews College in North Carolina for the quality of the programming. In 1992 as well, Thistle and Shamrock received a finalist certificate in the best regularly scheduled music program category from the New York Festival's International Radio Competition. Thistle and Shamrock has been on the air at KUAC FM since it went national. It continues to be here and stir the blood in Fairbanks. With us today on Conversations, its host and producer and the person who breathes life into it every week, Fiona Ritchie. You have been saying for the past half hour words that tell me that the traditions, ancient traditions of Celtic music, never grew old. Somehow they have... Well, I was thinking the last thing you said before we broke was that the pipes were banned. When they were brought back, they were reinstitutionalized. And I thought, well, that must have created a new kind of pipe music. Now, I don't know quite whether that's true, but this is the, I guess, the crux of the question, is that it seems like this ancient tradition stays alive, keeps growing, mm-hmm. keeps changing, and never loses whatever the core root is.
Yes, it does. You're right. It's been an ongoing set of traditions. Through time, though, for different reasons, they have been repackaged and represented back to the tradition bearers. Even fairly recently, I grew up in a time where the only Scottish music you might see on television would have been very kind of music hall, almost a parody of the tradition. Not particularly offensive, but certainly not very much to do with the authentic music of Scotland. It was sort of packaged and presented back to the Scots by whomever would have been in charge of the media at that time in a way that wasn't terribly recognisable, but that became almost considered to be, oh yeah, that's what our music's about. But still, the authentic music and the spirit of the music has continued on. And so during various periods, whether it's been Victorian parlour, sort of very formal singing, or music hall, or the TV tenors that we would have got in the 50s and 60s, the true tradition, the real gutsy singing and fiddle music and dance music has always sustained and continued and will always rise up beyond the various little phases that might have been attached to it. That's because I think it's never stopped, although there have been revivals and periods where it's become more popular and maybe faded a little bit again. It's always been there, and it's always been available to any current generation to seize hold of and make their own. So it's not kind of a tradition which exists in some kind of antique mm-hmm. showcase, you know, traditional music. It's something that's ongoing and organic, and it's a living tradition, which is why it's, you always hear people sort of in any various era of the music who will say, that's not traditional, that's not how it sounds, this is traditional and that's not. And I don't get too caught up in whether it is traditional or not, because if you did that, then we would never have had the fiddle. I mean, the fiddle at some point had to begin and come into the music, and other instruments like, as I said earlier, the Irish tenor banjo playing or even guitars and such like. And it's, I think, important that new influences come in all the time and breathe new life into the old traditions, as long as you don't abandon the music and its root and understand what the root is and respect that. So right now we're enjoying, in Scotland and Ireland, in fact the Irish really, I think, led the way with this, a great revival of interest amongst younger people in the music, and a great experimentation with what can be done with this music, what kind of rhythms can we try out and unlock within the music that haven't been done before, and let's see what it sounds like on this instrument. And I think that's great. So that's part of, yeah, what you're saying, it's an ongoing tradition, a living, breathing tradition, and that's why it's still around, because no one's been able to say, no, that's what it is, it's ended now. Traditional music stopped being traditional in 1707, and everything before that's traditional, everything since that's never happened, and it's continuing to grow and move.
This is an interesting notion, that by defining something, in some ways you might kill it, or stultify it anyway, mm-hmm. lock it down so it couldn't move.
And that's, you know, natural way we approach culture, I think, and that's been done, but it's never been quite successful in the case of this music.
So this is good.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Where do you take, in terms of its... in terms of its life force and complexity and willingness to try on new things, where do you take Celtic music to be now? Is it at the peak of experimentation? Is it beginning to move to something greater, drifting down?
I don't know. I almost used a term that's popular in Britain right now for very kind of satirical reasons of back to basics, which I won't go into. John Major's government has a campaign right now called Back to Basics, which has kind of backfired on them in interesting ways. But I was going to say that in some ways the music has been going back to basics, although not in the way John Major has in mind. But yes, people have... There was a great period during the 80s of, let's see how much we can do on keyboards and creating huge, lush backgrounds and orchestral-sounding strings and great keyboard washes to bring drama to this music and song. And that's been quite a fun time to hear. And also, at the same time, lots of different types of percussion ideas, some of them programmed and some of them, right, you know, bringing in African percussion instruments. And I don't know if people are getting a little tired of that now, or whether they're just saying, OK, that's been fun and we've learned some things now, but let's just hear what the fiddle sounds like on its own again. There's a little bit of that going on, particularly among younger people. They want to listen to the masters and play like they do. But you can't ever shut off influences that come in. And now we hear all kinds of... I mean, turn on your radio and you can hear music from all over the world and all different types of backgrounds, or the television, or you know, people share recorded music on compact discs from all over the place. And music travels like that now. It's instant. And you can't shut that off. Of course it's going to come in. And people who grew up listening to soul music and then go decide that they want to sing the ballads of their own land, they're going to have to be influenced by the Aretha Franklin they loved as a child or something. And I think that's just fine. And you can't stop that from happening. At the same time, I think some of the younger players are conscious of the fact that they want to learn some authentic style of fiddle playing in Shetland or in other parts of the country. So there's a consciousness, I think, of where the influences are coming from now, and a free approach to experimenting with them. But as I say, I'm hearing now in the very recent new releases of music coming out, people going for a more sparse sound, less heavily arranged. I don't know if that's a trend. We'll talk in a couple of years and find out if it was a trend.
Do you have music in your background? Or how did you come to this path in terms of your own raising and what you love and what attracts you?
I love all kinds of music, and you know, I grew up in Scotland, so there was Scottish music around if you were interested in it. Although, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And as I say, that was a time where it would have been difficult to turn on the radio and hear some authentic Scottish musical presentation singing or traditional music playing or the television, with the exception of accordion and fiddle bands, dance, country dance band music. A lot of the singing you would hear would have been, you know, a very operatic style soprano or tenor singing the songs of Robbie Burns or something like that, very beautifully, but maybe lacking the real gutsiness of the real traditional singer. So I grew up with that, although I remember first hearing music that sounded to me just exciting, and it was traditional fiddle music, or it was someone singing, and I wanted to seize hold of that. And there were one or two opportunities growing up to do that. My mum always really loved Scottish music and would sort of dance around the house. She'd always put on Scottish country dance music. Some earliest memories are of her dancing around the house, and she always loved Burns as a poet. And things Scottish were generally encouraged in our household. When I was, I suppose, about 10 or something, I was drafted into a children's choir, which became quite well known in the country, and we'd do radio broadcasts and on television. Mm. And in addition to singing all sorts of stuff, I mean, it was a very progressive approach. It'd be experimental choral pieces by Zoltan Kodály and people like that, and Irving Berlin and all sorts of stuff. Mm. There would also be Scottish traditional song done for a choir and four-part harmony in a very kind of highly arranged. But I always loved the Scottish songs best and developed maybe a love of some of these melodies and songs during those something like 6 years I was in that involvement. And then during university years, I was listening to all sorts of music and would always go along to hear the Boys of the Lock or whoever would come to the university at that time, and got to where that was my particular special thing that I liked. And there were others who also particularly enjoyed that and kind of encouraged that. But I wasn't a mad folky, really, in those days or anything. I liked all sorts of music and would go and hear, and still will, almost any kind of live music. When I got to North Carolina, what I really fell in love with was the sound of the old-timey string band music and the Appalachian music, and I could hear where it came from. And that just excited me, in a sense, hearing how our music had travelled and how it had developed in a different environment with a few other influences to become something else, but very strongly related. And that's what I got really interested in and wanted to play. And so I played guitar and I would play in these old-timey string band sessions for hours. And people would say, why don't you do a Scottish song? Or so, and I would say, no, I want to play this. This is great. So I usually would have one Scottish song that I would throw away so that people could then leave me alone to play with all these great old fiddle and banjo tunes. I thought that sounded great. It still sounds great to me. And then I started to get excited about other types of kind of indigenous American music, Cajun or whatever else I could get my ears on.
Do you think that's your greatest strength as a producer, is as kind of a musicologist? You see where things have come from, where they're going?
Yeah, I think I like music. I really like it. I love it. And I've got really open ears to it. And I suppose maybe my approach to the programme is that I'm maybe the number one big listener, you know, rather than that I'm sort of standing back and I'm on this side of the microphone and I pick music and produce it and I'm looking for the ethnomusical strains. Mm-hmm. I'm like the person on the other side of the radio who listens and knows what they like and what sounds good and what excites them. I'm one of the listeners, but I'm sort of doing it. Yeah. That's the way I hear it. So it's what sounds great to me and what excites me and what, you know, what I think is fun or interesting, that then I feel the folks who listen will also enjoy it. And to the extent that I can make connections for people, you know, and let them hear a whole lot of things together that they might never be able to get their hands on. Mm. So I'm doing that. I'm sort of making connections for people. Music that excites me, that's it.
Yeah, sorry. Mm. Are there always ideas? Do you ever wake up in the morning and say, God, I should have gone into psychology for real?
It's finally all dried up.
That's right.
That's not happened yet. I don't think that'll happen. If anything, the more music you hear, the more music you hear. And the last year, certainly during about a 3-4 month period last summer, I had more new releases, really good quality new releases of Celtic music sent to me than at any other time since the programme began. So if anything, there is something of a boom really going on in the recorded side of this music, and more of an interest in it, more of a lot of young artists coming up who want to talk about what they do. No shortage of ideas. And then, of course, moving back to Scotland in 1990 got me closer to the people who are making the music in Ireland as well. I've been able to go over there a lot more than when I was living in the States, of course. And it's more what will I do next of all these opportunities. So there's a lot of music going on, and people know that if they get in touch with me, that maybe there's a way to get their music out. So I don't think I'll run out of ideas.
Yeah. Seems on this side of the pond, so to speak, there's been what people call a Celtic revival. Green Linnet evidently is doing extremely well as a record producing company. There are American artists who are playing in various Celtic styles. Movies are coming out with Scottish soundtracks or Celtic soundtracks. I mean, it just feels like there's a happy home growing here.
Yes, and I think it's part of, and it exists as an area of interest on its own, I'm sure, but it's also related to a couple of other growths of interest that I've seen anyway, maybe you'll agree with me, during the 80s in world music.
Yes.
And also in acoustic-based music. You know, the growth, or the birth, I suppose, of types of music along the lines of what they called new age or new acoustic music at that time, under new labels like Windham Hill, you know, that was tremendously successful. And it's matured and it's done some other things too. So acoustic music, roots-based music, music that sounded, you know, the success of work that Paul Simon did, where he brought in Ladysmith Black Mambazo to sing with him. And people have criticised, you know, the motivation behind that. I don't know. That seems a shame, really. I think it's more fun to hear people experimenting and just enjoying their music together, and I think that's what's going on. This love of roots-based music, acoustic music, and music that sounds as if it comes from somewhere, I think maybe is what was happening during the 80s. I think people got maybe just a little bit tired, weary of music that was created just to sell itself, and music that sounds like it's happening for the sake of the music, and if it becomes popular as well, that's great, I think is what maybe happened. And so Celtic music fits nicely amongst really almost all of these categories, doesn't it? So maybe the revival of interest in Celtic music is a little bit to do with all of those things.
Meaning that music worldwide is opening up. There was a concern that everything would begin to sound the same, but it sounds more like greater and greater differentiation is flowing out into the world.
Yeah, although the sharp lines of definition between musical categories are blurring, and you get someone like Wynton Marsalis winning a Grammy in the same year for a jazz and a classical music recording. And so there are some breakthroughs going on in all the crossover areas between all sorts of music. But yes, perhaps more of an excitement in music in a broader sense maybe than ever before. And then, you know, there is the American, specifically American interest in reaching back to family roots and origins. And there are so many people in all over the United States whose family origins are from Scotland or Ireland, and they like to get in touch with that.
Roots. Fiona Ritchie is with us today on Conversations. Once again, Thistle and Shamrock debuted in North Carolina, in Charlotte, on the nearly very brand new WFAE-FM in Charlotte, North Carolina, July 1981. It made its national debut June 4, 1983, on American Public Radio, was carried on American Public Radio until 1989. Oh, I see. I was in error a minute ago. I thought I was.
Actually, it was 90. Let's just 1990? Add another year onto that as we update the...
I'd like to be completely confused, yes.
Yeah, the program went to National Public Radio the same year I went back to Scotland,
right.
Basically, is how that happened. But in 86, which was a date that you touched on earlier on, that was really when I went full-time just producing the programme, after my work at the radio station had been in promotion and fundraising for WFAE, which was a growing public radio station, and we raised a lot of money, and it, became, you know, it's a great station. And then in 86, you know, I had to make that decision because the programme was growing and the station was growing, and I was going to have to really give up one or the other. So I thought, well, I can always say I did a radio programme for a couple of years, so I'll give that up and I'll, you know, focus in on the desk job here at WFAE. And then I woke up, literally did wake up one morning and thought, I've got this priority plan totally upside down, and decided to give up the job and to focus full time on the show for however long it would go, and it's still going.
Yeah. Was that a response to who Fiona is? To wake up that morning and say, oh, wait a minute, I need, this is my creative life here.
Do you mean, do I often do that kind of thing?
No. Was the decision itself one that responded to a core Fiona?
I suppose it was. You know, when you're never so aware of what's going on at the time, but when I look back, I can see that pretty much all along I was following a feeling rather than following some kind of sensible scheme for how I might live my life or something. So going full time on the show and even changing networks, you know, which was a difficult thing to do at the time, and going back to Scotland, all these things have felt right, and that's pretty much, I suppose, how the programme's continued and how we've let it grow. It's not been part of some 10-year plan, you know, right. At all. Mm. Absolutely not. And still isn't. It's where it seems to want to go, and you let it go there.
Is there a thistle and shamrock in Scotland? Do you have or want to have a radio program there?
Well, I don't.
Is it Coles to Newcastle?
It could be. I don't do the Thistle and Shamrock in Scotland, but I do host a weekly programme for BBC Radio Scotland called Celtic Connections, which was the programme which they created for me, in a sense. I suppose they wanted to do a programme involving me. I had done a whole lot of different sorts of work for them, one-off specials on the links between Scotland and North Carolina through music, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And I'd filled in on a lot of programmes for them when people were vacationing and that sort of stuff, and, you know, had fun doing live radio, because I really like doing that. And of course, the Thistle and Shamrock, sorry to disappoint everyone, but doesn't come out live out of KUAC. It's a recorded show, so it's quite fun to...
People are crushed,
aren't they?
Everywhere.
Aren't they, though? Yeah. Sorry about that. So, to be able to get on live radio and do that, you know, that was quite a fun thing to do. But eventually, they said they'd like me to do this programme. So I host Celtic Connections, which is quite different from the Thistle and Shamrock, because what that programme does is it takes Celtic music and places it in an international context of music. The connections I most like to touch on are the North American ones, but also we'll play African music, we'll play anything which might have, you know, have a rootedness which has something in common with Celtic music. Not that you're picking up from a fiddle tune and going, oh, listen, this is a similar rhythm in this music from Madagascar, because it's not, you know, and you can't. In fact, when we first did the first couple of programmes, I said to the producer, so what's the tenuous Celtic connection here? And then I realised, I said, I know what it is. The Celtic connection between all these pieces of music is me, you know, because the music didn't seem connected at all, except that it sits well together. It sounds good together. So we do that, and that's on BBC Radio Scotland, and that's been quite fun. And interesting, we sideline on that whole subject, is that it seems to be a relatively recent development in Scottish radio that it's actually actively encouraged, not just okay, but actively encouraged to have a Scottish accent. When I was growing up, even on Scottish radio, everyone sounded very anglicised, and you really couldn't get on the radio unless you started to lose your Scottish accent and sort of talk a bit like this. So, it was just interesting. It was the BBC English.
Sure.
And, again, part of a whole lot of different kinds of cultural vibrancy in the country has been an enjoyment of and a relaxation with the sounds of our own voices. And so now you will hear lots of regional Scottish accents on the airwaves, my own included, you know, as regional as it may or may not be anymore.
Have you tried to, was there a point in your announcing either for North Carolina or where you tried to leave the lilt behind?
Well, it was suggested to me, in fact, one or two people in at WFAE hate that I bring this up and even actually now deny that it ever happened, but there was a small attempt in there to get me to lose the accent, and it just was a dismal failure. I mean, I obviously wasn't made to lose this way of speaking. It's not that I've tried to keep it in all these years in North Carolina or gone home at night and done, you know, vocal exercises or anything to hold on to the accent. It's just very ingrained in me. Mm. But when I first was at the station, first of all, the station manager encouraged my being there and to learn about radio. But she said, you know, you do realise that with, you know, your accent, you'll never be on the air. Are you comfortable with that? And I said, yeah, that's fine. I have no big plans to do that. I'm just really interested in the radio station. Great. So she said, no going on the air for you. But then another person who was working at the station at that time, the radio station was airing promos for Sherlock Holmes, Lord Peter Wimsey, and other BBC dramas, thought it would be a great idea if I could do all the promos, but I would have to use an English accent, of course. So I went into the studio, and I suppose that was the first sort of on-air stuff I did for the station, was to cut promos, mm-hmm. and put on a fake English BBC accent, which she thought was great. And then the next round of promos I did, I just kind of, you know, I just sort of didn't try so hard. And then the next week, I just used my own voice, and no one said, Fiona, I get back into the BBC. No one noticed or cared. And then they asked me to do promos for all the other shows as well, Star Wars and everything, where my accent had absolutely nothing to do with it. And they forgot that the idea had been to get me to talk with this English accent to do the BBC drama.
Did you go home and think you'd pulled one over? Did you say, yes?
Well, I suppose at the time, see, now I would have thought, I'm not going to change my accent for you. At the time, I thought, well, fair enough, you know, I do have a very strong accent. Of course, it can't go on the air like this. So I was quite happy to change. And I don't think I went home and punched the air and laughed about pulling one over. I was just being me. I mean, I couldn't keep faking it. So I just thought, well, good, I'm glad they didn't really notice. I'll just keep doing this. And then the station manager, who had said, you can't go on the air with that accent, was the one who got me to do the programme, and she was also the one who put it up for national distribution and got behind it really 100%. And she herself likes to tell the story more than anyone of trying to keep me off mic. So she deserves a lot of credit really for what I'm doing now.
This is again just kind of a staircase step into confidence in Celtic music will be welcomed, the voice of the host will be welcomed. We can try more, less mainstream music on the program, yes.
Well, don't you think maybe also all that maybe was happening at a time, at the right time in the history of public radio?
Yes.
Because I remember when I first came over, a lot of the voices you would hear on national radio, public radio, were pretty much not regional American voices either. They were, as they would say over here, I suppose, flat Midwestern accents, non-accents, still an accent to my ears, but, you know, not a regional accent. And during the earliest days of my programme, I think was also a time when we started to hear Southern accents, New England tones or whatever on the American airwaves. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, my voice coming on, whilst it would have sounded, you know, a lot different to what people are used to hearing, it was part of a relaxing of the American expectations of what they want to hear on the airwaves too. So I suppose there's been a lot of accidents of timing that have been quite fortuitous for the programme. Mm-hmm. You know, that aren't in your control.
NPR puts out a Fiona fact sheet, which made me smile. And on it, it said, short-term goals, she answers, to get there. Long-term goals, she answers, to get there. Is this part of your sense that what is this?
I'm not sure. I mean, they gave me this thing to fill in, which I did. And, you know, one or two of the questions you think long and hard about, like some question like, which famous people, living or dead, would you invite to a dinner party? And then you go, okay, who would I like to have my dinner party? And you think about it, and you go away and come back and you actually drop one of the people and put someone else in instead. But those questions, I just answered that immediately, you know. Those were my answers, and that is how I feel about what I do, and not just in my work. I feel like I'm trying to get somewhere all the time, on the very short term, on the medium term, and on the long term. I hope not in an unhealthy way, you know, but that there is I do feel a forward momentum all the time about my energy and my life. And I like to think I sort of stop to pet the cat and go out cross-country skiing enough to really enjoy life too. But there's definitely that getting there.
And is the there...
Where is there?
Changing all the
time? Yeah, I think it is. I think it definitely is. Getting, you know, going back to Scotland would have been a there at one time, and now I am there. So there'll be another there now.
What's next?
Emigrating to Alaska, probably.
Now that's a joke. Not that it's not a wonderful place, but what's the next there?
I'm not sure right now, actually. Not sure right now. There have been a lot of changes since I went back to Scotland now, working, you know, on an ongoing basis for the BBC. Wasn't a particular goal of mine, I have to say, because I wasn't sure I could really afford the time. In fact, it was only when I really felt that working with the Thistle and Shamrock transatlantically was really in a nice stride pattern, and that everything was working well, and there was a good sense that the programme had, you know, become enriched by my going back in the content, and I was happy with that, that I felt comfortable about taking time to do this BBC programme. So that wasn't a particular goal, but I'm enjoying it, so that's good. And there are other things that are developing from doing that that might be quite fun, but aren't particular goals. If they happen, that would be all right. I think I'm just trying to, you know, I have some family back in Scotland that I've been enjoying being closer to since I went back, and I'm quite enjoying some of that and the sense of being part of the Scottish community in life again. Because even when I first came back, I don't think I really was. I was very much straddling two countries and not quite settled in either for a while. And that's, I don't feel that anymore. So yeah, there isn't a burning goal that I'm shooting for right now, but I am, things are still moving nicely. And, you know, how's that for a very vague... vague response.
A good vague response. Fiona Ritchie, thanks for a good hour. Vague hour. No. A good hour.
Vaguely, I have to say thanks.
Well, vaguely, you're welcome. I'm Susan McGuinness. This has been Conversations this week with Fiona Ritchie from The Thistle and Shamrock. If you're not a Thistle and Shamrock fan, become one every Saturday on KUAC FM at 1 o'clock.